Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's January 17th, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Today's program is sandwiched between two webcasts by Lyndon LaRouche, so I want to begin by making sure that all our listeners know that Mr. LaRouche gave a powerfully efficient briefing yesterday, which is posted on LaRouchePAC.com. He was speaking to the transition team, to leaders of governments of Russia, China, India, and to the American people. And he was laying out the nature of this present crisis, how dangerous it is, its causes, and the policy orientation which will allow us to overcome it. So I would urge everyone to go to LaRouchePAC.com and listen to that. And then he'll be speaking again this Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern, again on LaRouchePAC.com. This will be 2 days after the inauguration of a new president. And I would urge everyone to organize everyone you know to listen to it. Today we're going to be looking at one of the crises that President-elect Obama will inherit when he becomes president of the United States on Tuesday. And that is of the disintegration of our neighbor to the south, Mexico, which is being turned into a failed narco-terror state. My guests on the program today just completed an excellent documentary for LPAC TV titled Nahuapa Plino, The Future of the Americas. Tarana Dorsey and Freddie Coronel were leaders of a team of LaRouche Youth Movement members which produced this, and I highly recommend it. It is also on the LaRouche PAC site, and this is a work of art. So, Freddie in Tarana, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thanks, Harley.
Hello, thank you.
Tarana, I want to begin by just looking at this broadly. What is the subject of this documentary?
Well, Harley, as the title indicates, or the subtitle, that is, The Future of the Americas, the video really emphasizes or focuses on the process which has led relations specifically between United States and Mexico to be where they are today, going through the period of a better period of relations with Franklin Roosevelt, but the policies which related in the shift after Roosevelt's death, the introduction of Kissinger and the NSSM 200, and then what kind of potential exists today, given the global financial crisis, to move out of that and into hopefully something that restores the tradition of Roosevelt and the relation between the Americas that existed at that time.
And when you say we had better relations, what is the characteristic when the U.S. and Mexico have good relations? What is that based on?
Well, as we indicate in the video, really we have a common cause and we have a common history, specifically the United States and Mexico. And something that Lyndon LaRouche has outlined repeatedly is the tradition of the United States from the best of European culture, that really the people who came here and also in Mexico had the idea of bringing the best of culture and the concept of the uniqueness of the human mind and of the human individual to the Americas. And that was the original tradition that we both share, which, you know, in the time of Lincoln and Juarez manifested itself in the fight against the British Empire and colonization, but also in the time of Franklin Roosevelt, as he himself emphasized when he visited Monterrey, Mexico, the development, the joint development of the resources of both nations for the improvement and the general welfare of both of our populations.
And I noticed in the video you have a clip of Franklin Roosevelt's trip to Monterey. That was very interesting.
Yes, that was quite a find and very hopefully will be very powerful for people to see him speaking in his own words about the fight for that joint development and how exploitation of the resources of Mexico must end immediately.
And you told me that we are going to put out a Spanish language version of the documentary?
Yes, it's already completed. It's just a few technical matters, and it will be also up on the website, and then a DVD will be going into production that has both the English and the Spanish versions.
Now, Freddie, I know that you have some specific familiarity with the situation in Mexico. You've been there on a couple of Mr. LaRouche's trips. You were there as one of the original activists from the LaRouche Youth Movement helped build the LaRouche Youth Movement in Mexico. I imagine when you look at the country today and you see the damages that's been done to the economy and the discussion of Mexico as a potential failed narco-terror state, that this has a pretty profound impact on you.
It's interesting. Just over the last few years, as LaRouche's forecast had come into play or had unfolded, and the crisis was no longer deniable, we used a lot of the different videos and the website to take advantage of the crisis and really present to people what the cause of this was. And of course, now with this incoming administration, you know, they have to deal with a lot of these existential threats. And in the case of Mexico, I was there organizing with a few other members of the LaRouche movement, and it wasn't as bad as it is today. And I'm talking in particular of the narco terror problem. And, you know, in places like Mexico City, and of course at that time, drugs weren't legalized in Mexico. But just over the last few months, the crisis had surmounted to such a degree that, as LaRouche had stated in yesterday's webcast, you know, that this presents not just a threat to the nation of Mexico, but it also presents a threat to the United States. And so in that context, you know, we put out this video as the first of hopefully a series of other videos with respect to foreign policy towards Mexico and towards the Americas in general, in hopes that, you know, people would really understand what type of system the United States should promote in order for there to be peace amongst these different countries. And so that's what we really try to do with this documentary, is present an initial blow to many people who are ignorant of why Mexico has reached the state of degeneration and terror that it has, and why the United States is in a crisis today. What's the similarity with those policies? And of course, by taking that approach that Tarana had mentioned, you know, with the relation between Roosevelt and these nations in Ibero-America, you know, why that's going to be necessary for the development of the United States and the rest of the world.
One of the big changes, of course, was NAFTA, North American Free Trade Act. And I know when you and I were there, I think in 2002, maybe it was 2003, there was still an illusion with many Mexicans, especially in Mexico City, that NAFTA was good for the country. Do you think that's changing, and how has NAFTA affected Mexico?
I haven't been there over the last number of months, but I have noticed that there's been a dramatic change here in the United States. So generally, people in third world countries are more apt to these crises than, you know, people in the United States and in other developed countries. But over the last number of months, you know, just your average citizen has now finally come to admit that, yes, we are in a financial crisis. And so you see this all over the place. And, you know, actually one interesting thing I should mention, in this documentary, two supporters of ours had gone into Mexicali with a video camera to capture a lot of footage, and of particularly of the border town areas and in different parts of Mexicali. And they had interviewed some of the people that were living in that area, and they interviewed some of people that were actually deported back into Mexico who had decided to stay in the border town areas, just, you know, because they figured that, one, a lot of them try to make it back into the United States, but then also, you know, they figured that they're better off there than, you know, from the southern regions of Mexico from whence they came. And it's pretty shocking, because they're just like, you know, look, it's just bad. You know, actually, one of the people that they interviewed was a 27-year-old person, and he had said, well, you know, I just recently got deported, and, you know, before in the United States, you know, I had some work, but then it became more and more difficult to find work in the United States. Even though it's much better than it is in Mexico, it's still reaching that stage. So I think on both sides, yes, people are finally recognizing that there has to be a change in the overall system. And I think in this documentary, we have our the editor for Ibero-American Operations, Dennis Small, who details very well the success that NAFTA has had, not just in Mexico, but also in the United States. And, of course, what he means by success was, you know, the overall intention of NAFTA to depopulate Mexico, to destroy its physical economy by destroying its infrastructure. Primarily, its domestic production of food was an absolute success for Mexico. And, of course, just what it's done to family farms in the United States and everything that comes with that. So I think this documentary paints that very, very clearly. And like I said, we do have an opportunity now to change these policies with the incoming administration.
Well, I think the comments you're mentioning of Dennis Small were very effective because he presented them with the proper kind of irony. Because when most people talk about success with NAFTA, they say, well, gee, the Mexican economy is doing so much better. But the actual the picture on the ground is horrible. And one of the points, Freddie, that you guys document is this question of the immigration. What was it, 13 million? Is that the figure since NAFTA, the 13 million new immigrants to the United States? And how many of these are now being sent back to Mexico?
We're looking at millions. I mean, it's kind of hard to target. I think already it's probably a little over 2 million people over the last perhaps maybe year, year and a half that's been sent back into Mexico.
And right now they're coming back to Mexico without an opportunity to work in Mexico, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty desperate situation. I mean, we have six border states in Mexico, and a number of the immigrants that have been deported, you know, get dropped off in those border states. And that's where you have the majority amount of narco trafficking and the problems of narco trafficking. For example, in the case of this area called Matamoros, it's in the state of Tamaulipas. And that border,
it's right on the southern Texas border.
Right, exactly. You have that in the southern Texas border. You have some problems with that in the state of Sonora, which borders the state of Arizona. And then, of course, the recent crime waves that we've seen in TJ, in Baja California, which borders California. And so,
and don't forget Ciudad Juarez, which is that borders El Paso. Major problems there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so then you have a lot of the immigrants that get deported. And because the situation is so desperate, I mean, these border states are just extremely underdeveloped. In the case of Sonora, there's a serious water shortage. It's still a desert, and you have this with many neighboring states.
And that brings us to the real topic of the documentary. I just want to identify for our listeners that this is the LaRouche Show. You can send questions, email questions to Freddie and Tarana at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And you can go to larouchepat.com to see this documentary. So, Freddie, you were talking about the water shortage. Let me just turn to Tarana now. Tarana, what is Plino?
Well, Plino, which is correctly spelled P-L-H-I-N-O, stands for Plan Hidráulico Noroeste, or the Northwest Hydraulic Plan. And one thing, just to transition into what that is in the context of what we were discussing, currently we have a political force on the ground known as the Pro-Plino Committee, located in Sonora, but operating in that entire area, which has been doing a lot of on-the-ground work to educate people and really push this through. But just to illustrate for people, maybe to give them a picture in their mind of really what this situation is, Alberto Vizcarra, who is one of the members of the Pro-Plino Committee, had published an article or a pamphlet that we put together that we'd been distributing on the ground there called Plino o Caos, Plino or Chaos. Where he illustrates very thoroughly the combination of people who are, because of the collapse of the United States economy, returning to Mexico, to these very border states that we're discussing, at the same time as you have still people in the, you know, more southern or below, further below the border regions of Mexico who are still coming to the border to attempt to come to the United States because the situation in Mexico is no better. For instance, the collapse of the peso, the lack of food in the midst of this food crisis, such that you have a real ferment and a tension building up, especially in this border region, which is then further aggravated by the just immense increase in narco-terrorism in those very regions, just in the, as Freddie mentioned, just in the past few months, where, you know, people are daily bombarded with images of decapitated people, women, you know, there's widows all over the place because of people losing their, you know, their spouses, where even the point where police chiefs are consistently being assassinated such that nobody wants to be the police chief anymore because
Lyndon LaRouche said there's a price on the head of the president.
Yes. So in that, that's almost in a sense the perfect storm kind of environment for what we described, what Vizcarra described as the chaos kind of situation that Mexico is faced with, unless Mexico goes with something like this Plino project, which is not just, I'll say what it is first. It's the proposal was originally put forward in the 1960s, was developed by the Mexican College of Engineers, specifically by a man named Jose Manuel Frias, an engineer, who currently is associated with the Plena Committee and with our movement. And at the time, there was already a very specific problem of a lack of water in this northwest region of Mexico, even though the soil there is potentially the best kind of soil you could have for production of corn, wheat, all the staple crops that not only the people in Mexico depend on, but is completely in demand in the world right now. For people here, or people in California, it might help illustrate that the Imperial Valley, for instance, the soils in the northwest of Mexico are very similar, almost the same content. And as we can see here, the Imperial Valley for the United States and the world. And that's the kind of potential that exists in the northwest of Mexico were there to be water. And
Rana, we lost you there for a second, but I think that's when you were talking about the Imperial Valley. For those of the listeners who are not from California, this was desert area that as soon as water was brought in, became some of the most fertile land in the country and provided up to 40% of leafy green vegetables for U.S. consumption. So that's the kind of potential soil we're talking about.
Yes, exactly. And the question of water is something also very specific in the case of Mexico because there is an immense amount of precipitation, rainfall, and water that right now exists just in the form of runoff from many rivers located in the western Sierra Madre in Mexico that flow out, where that water in this, as the Plino project has proposed, can be transferred through a series of dams and tunnels up along the western coast of Mexico into this northwest region, which would create, you know, as we've discussed with the example of the Imperial Valley, a complete breadbasket for not only the population of Mexico, but for mankind. And aside from the question of just food production, as we can see from our discussion about the kind of chaos that is fermenting in these regions right now, if you look at the kind of job production, the kind of skilled and unskilled work that would be required just to build this project, it's tremendous. It would be, as one of my colleagues described, it would almost be for Mexico like the Moon Project was, not in terms of scale, but in terms of optimism and how it would be seen by the population of Mexico and what it would mean for other nations in the world.
Well, now I'm going to ask Freddie a question, which presupposes that many of our fellow Americans are quite ignorant of these kinds of matters. So if you're one of our listeners and you know what I'm talking about, don't think I'm talking about you. But Freddie, as you know, you just heard what Tarana described, the idea of creating a breadbasket, creating jobs for Mexico. And a lot of Americans will respond by saying, well, first of all, who's going to finance it? And secondly, how do we know, since Mexico is so corrupt, how do we know if we help them get credit, it will actually go into the Pleno? So how do you answer the question of the typical American with his head in the sand saying, why should we care about Mexico? It's their problem.
We come up against that challenge a lot, just organizing and on the grassroots level here in the United States. You also get it as well, organizing on a grassroots level in Mexico, you know, where the average citizen in Mexico will, you know, say the same thing, but just in reverse. You know, how can we do this when the United States has always been an empire, and you know, this is going to be for their interests and not for the interests of Mexico?
So we got to teach people history then.
Yeah. I think one fun way just to get at it is exactly what you said. You know, they have all these assumptions about, you know, Mexico being so corrupt, but really when it comes down to it, it is a matter of figuring out what is the United States really all about. And, of course, the irony being that, you know, in the case of Mexico, it was at large degree founded on the same idea that founded the United States. I mean, that was the intention. I think in the documentary, Lyndon LaRouche puts it very clearly that the best thinkers of Europe had come over to the Americas to colonize it with the intention of establishing the best that Europe had to offer, but here in the Americas. So it's not as if Mexico was developed with a separate motive or a separate ideal as the United States was, but in fact the same ideas that Hamilton and Washington had discussed and Ben Franklin had discussed was pretty much the whole idea of what we wanted to spread throughout all of the Americas. So we have that same interest. It's not separate.
Well, I think also it's somewhat ironic that when we see headlines about the Madoff $50 billion Ponzi scheme, the banks getting $350 billion in bailout of taxpayers' money, when Americans talk about Mexican corruption, they ought to take a look in their own capital, and I think that's why we need a PCORA commission in the United States. But let me come back to this point, because you know, we're going to have, I think this documentary does address this very effectively, the question of the common interests. But you still have this problem of Americans who say, well, we've got our own problems. How does helping Mexico help us address our own problems? So either of you want to take that up?
Well, I can say one thing on it, which might put this somewhat in perspective. First of all, that question really reflects a disease which our entire population and leadership has been afflicted with at least for the last 40 years, which is known as monetarism, which is thinking in monetary terms and thinking that some amount of money being put forward that those people won't see in some form of something for themselves that will please themselves can't possibly be of any use to them. And this, you know, as the entire history of the development of our nation has illustrated and proven, is a completely false idea. Something I was really amused by in LaRouche's webcast yesterday was when he was presented with a question from the transition team of the Obama administration, the incoming Obama administration, on, you know, tax cuts and should we do this and that for poor people in the United States and how do we go about it. He started talking about how the best kind of the best policy for New York City in terms of their transportation system was to have the transportation almost completely free, because it was actually more cost, even in terms of being cost effective, it was better to have a cheaper and more and almost free public transportation system than it would be to set up everything to be able to charge people however much money off of this transportation system. And with these joint development projects that have been proposed, the NOAPA, which maybe we'll cover in this discussion
sure.
in a little bit, and the Plino, the Northwest Hydraulic Plant in Mexico. Both of these projects are specifically in Mexico. From our investigation, 85% of what's required in terms of cement, steel, workers, trucks for transportation of the cement, etc., can actually be domestically supplied or developed by Mexico, which means that any capital budget which was developed for that would be peso-denominated. And the remaining 15%, 15 to 25% of what would need to be covered or supplied in terms of technology, higher-end technology by other nations could be something that would be taken care of by Mexico's Pemex, which is their nationalized oil fund that they have. So really, in monetary terms, that's not the issue at all. It has nothing to do with people here, you know, footing the bill for some poor savage in Mexico. What this really has to do with is the kind of joint policy direction that our nations must take together to be able to have these kind of development projects. So that's something hopefully people to think about.
Now, Freddie, I had a question that someone asked me yesterday that I want to direct to you, which has to do with this the situation with the government in Mexico. Why is it that the Mexican government hasn't proceeded with Plino? I know that Toronto reported there's a pro-Plino committee. Is it the case that there's actually an anti-Plino faction in the Mexican government?
Well, it's interesting. there's this grouping centered around this guy named Tamargo, who heads up this committee called CONAWA. And, you know, they generally look over a lot of the, not just the water supplies in Mexico, but looking at different hydraulic projects for Mexico. And the Plino project itself, in comparison to the North American Water and Power Alliance, is it's not as challenging of a project. But nonetheless, it's something that is very beneficial for all of the Americas. And as Toronto pointed out, this project was conceived of in the 60s, and it could have been built within a decade. But because of, you know, the different policy changes, it never had got implemented. Over the last few years, as the Pro Plino Committee had a lot of success in getting different state legislators and even the governor of Sonora to endorse the Plino project, they had allotted, the group CONAWA had allotted $2 million to conduct an investigative study report of the Plino. And unfortunately, though, that money never came through. And when Tamargo was questioned on it, you know, what happened to all the money, I mean, he just simply stated, look, the Plino is just an old project, we're not going to go with it, and that's it. But come to find out, the money was all spent. And interestingly enough, Tamargo was also part of different organizations that were sponsored by, in some cases started by, George Soros. And George Soros, for some of our listeners who might be new to the program and new to our political action committee, he's somebody who is a drug pusher and who has endorsed a lot of money to keep third world countries underdeveloped. And so, of course, this is in the interest of a lot of different British factions that use environmentalism as a way to prevent projects like the Plino from being constructed. Unfortunately, George Soros, not just in the case of this Plino project, but in general, the control that Soros has had through these different narco groups in Mexico, it's just led to general chaos, thereby preventing the Plino. So yes, we do have specific people in the Mexican government that have intended to prevent the Plino from being constructed, but at the same time, these are people that are part of an overall grouping to make sure that Mexico doesn't develop, period, whether it be through the Plino or education or anything else.
One of the things that I discussed with Lyndon LaRouche last month when we were talking about the work that was going to be done in the documentary is that I asked him how he thinks about Plano. And one of the things that he said is that this is something that Soros doesn't want, because Plano would represent a commitment of the state of Mexico to the nation of Mexico to function as a sovereign nation state, to develop its economy for its people. And that kind of nation state undermines Soros' ability to loot, that Soros would actually prefer the kind of lawless narco-terror on the borders and also in Mexico City, because it prevents the state from acting for its people. Now, this is something that I think is significant in terms of looking at the United States. And I want to bring up the NAWAPA question because, you know, someone might say, well, Mexico, it's a third world country, it's corrupt, that's why they didn't build it. Well, we had a program going back to the 60s called the North American Water and Power Alliance, which is also a part of this NAWAPA Plano. So, Toronto, why don't you tell us a little bit about NAWAPA and why was NAWAPA not implemented in the United States?
Well, just to give the listener a broad idea of what the how the NAWAPA project originated and what it encompasses, it also, as Freddie already mentioned, I think, originated in the 1960s, and it arose in the context of our nation, especially on the West Coast here, having to face a real question of water supply and where we would be able to, or how we would be able to develop a reliable water supply, given that previous to that time, the majority of the water supply that's been developed in the United States has been from drawing upon water basins, existing water basins, or river basins. For instance, the Colorado River, which, you know, through the Hoover Dam has played a tremendously significant role here, and then thus for the food production of the entire country and world. However, in the 1960s, people started to think about a real problem, which is that you can only draw upon, you can only support a certain population level or have a certain level of development that draws upon the same amount of water for so long. And then the question begins to turn to the future, and if development continues, which it should, where or how will we be able to develop the ability to produce, in a sense, water? And there's really two ways to do it. One is through desalination of water, which is something, you know, that absolutely needs to be done and has been done on smaller scales in various places. And the other is the transference of water, which requires a real long-term planning and engineering commitment. In the case of the NAWAPA, the Parsons Company, which is actually centered out of California, composed a proposal to take runoff, a large amount of runoff from main river systems up in Alaska, the Yukon River, and the Alaska and the Yukon Territory in Canada, and to, through a system of canals, pump lifts, even a man-made canal in the Rocky Mountain Trench, bring that water down through Canada, through the United States, and even all the way down into Mexico. So, I mean, there's a lot more detail on, you know, the pump lifts and the rivers, et cetera, but that's something that we can leave for listeners to investigate on their own time.
But this is a
also
project.
I want to add with respect to that, there was a committee in the Senate at the time that had put together a report, not just on NAWAPA, but looking at NAWAPA and all the other water development projects that were proposed for the west of the United States, and in general just for the United States. And NAWAPA itself was clearly the most energy effective and just most powerful water development project that the United States had at the time. And there was a lot of support from different, you know, representatives in different states. But this was around the time of the mid-60s, late 60s. And at the same time, this is where you did have a growth of the environmentalist movement in the United States. And actually, there were different environmentalist groups in Canada and even in the United States that opposed the Nawapa project from being constructed. And so, you know, unfortunately, even though there was still a lot of support that went into it and up and through the 70s and early 80s, the Nawapa project never was completed.
Yeah, had Nawapa and Plano been completed, you would have a totally different situation in the southwest of the United States, the northwest desert area of Mexico, and also Nawapa included replenishing water in the Great Lakes and the Ogallala Aquifer on the U.S. side. Now, this brings me to the next thing I want to take up, which is Lyndon LaRouche's conception of infrastructure, that it's not just a question of dams and canals and machinery, but he actually talks about this from the standpoint of how you develop the capabilities, the creative capabilities of your workforce. And this is directly connected to the idea of a 25 to 50 to 100 year mission orientation. Both of you emphasized that this was being, for both the United States and Mexico, these plans were available in the 60s. They could already be in place. Now, here we are 40 years later, and we don't have them. I'd like both of you to talk a little bit. I know, Tarana, you were in the basement, which is sort of a mythical thing for listeners of the LaRouche Show. We once had a supporter who said, I'm not giving you any more support because LaRouche is locking people in the basement to teach them things. But so I'd like you to talk about this idea of infrastructure from the standpoint of how we have the capability to unleash the creative potential of a generation with this kind of optimistic 25, 50, 2 and 3 year, 2 and 3 generation mission orientation.
Sure. Well, one thing, I guess the best place to start is looking at real physical economy, because infrastructure, you know, a lot of people, especially now, like,
oops, we seem to have lost you there, Tarana.
Our governor of California here loves to talk about infrastructure. So infrastructure in and of itself doesn't necessarily mean something that's going to be beneficial for mankind. When you're driving on the 267 in Washington and paying that toll, you know, I don't think people really have a sense of the usefulness of a road. But in the context, as LaRouche has developed it, of looking at the relationship between the abiotic, non-living things on this earth, living things, the so-called biosphere, as it's been called, and then cognitive processes, which thus far mankind solely reflects, known as the noosphere, there's a transformation that occurs with the introduction of these kinds of large-scale infrastructure projects, which have a completely different significance than anything else that we know of. And something that we really tried to playfully illustrate and emphasize in the video was the relationship between a national government introducing a long-term infrastructure project, for instance, the Rural Electrification Program, or the Tennessee Valley Authority in Franklin Roosevelt's time, where with the introduction of that kind of structure.
Tarana? I think we've lost her for a moment there. See, with technology, we're still dealing with these digital technologies that don't quite function. Tarana, can you hear me? Well, Freddie, can you pick up on what she was discussing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, and Tarana, whenever you get back on, just jump in. Oh, that's probably her.
Tarana? Yeah, we lost you there for a moment. Go ahead, you were talking about, go ahead.
Where did you lose me?
You were talking
REA,
about...
You were talking about the REA,
oh,
and then...
okay,
yeah,
great.
Yeah,
so what these projects illustrated is that with the introduction of this kind of basic economic infrastructure, the role of the individual producer, be it the farmer or the factory worker, although their efforts, the amount of work output that they're doing, it does not change, their productivity is completely transformed. Just with the introduction of something like electricity and what that allows for a small family farmer to be able to produce in a given amount of time.
And Freddie, in terms of this idea of how you create optimism, you know, I think that one of the biggest problems we've had, one of the biggest casualties of the last 40 years of the attack on science, the imposition of the baby boomer culture of me, 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 is that people no longer think in terms of 25 to 50 year infrastructure cycles. Do you see that this is something with NWAPA, with Plano, with space exploration, that we can take a new generation which seems to be caught up in video games and short attention span? Do you think we can get them back to the idea of a morality of production?
It's going to take a while. It's going to be part of a overall longer term process. But I think we can absolutely can do it. I mean, I think to take back from the question that you had just asked earlier and now, I mean, I think for the listeners, you know, the ones who are more aware of the overall crisis and have been visiting the website weekly and watching the different webcasts that LaRouche has given and watched the webcast from yesterday, I think for those, it's very important to realize that in the case of a human being, you know, although the general way that we teach young people today, whether it be in elementary, on an elementary level, or even in college today, human beings don't just simply retain information and then from that information just simply change. You know, generally that's what you'll find. You'll just sit people in front of a computer and, you know, you can just have different videos or you know, just whatever, visit the internet and visit Wikipedia, and then, you know, you'll find everything out from there. The best way that human beings learn and change is by being involved in some form of a process, in some form of a physical process. And I think today, with the incoming administration and all the different challenges that this country and the institution of the presidency is going to have to deal with, we, by demonstrating real political change, is how I think we can start changing the culture. So first and foremost, it is going to be a matter now of having a political identity. You know, here the Bush administration was just involved in the most horrendous of activities. And now, you know, this coming Tuesday, we're going to see, you know, a Democrat, you know, be sworn into office after all these years. But it's not that easy. You know, I think that if we ourselves participate in aiding the United States government and promoting the right type of policies, we'll start getting a better sense as to how to change these things. Now, it's not in any liberal way. I mean, I think there's a lot of policy initiatives that we've put out on our website that people can stand behind. For instance, in this issue of the NWAP and Plano project, also the idea of promoting nuclear energy. I think the more and more and more we tackle on that type of identity, where we see ourselves as, in a sense, legislators. You know, we may not be in office, but nonetheless, we still have a voice, and we can have an influence in policy shaping in this country. I think through that, we can start influencing a lot of particularly students to be involved in that process. And I think that's the best way that we can begin to change it, because it's through that will then start to have longer-term effects for the next 20 years. I think that's one of the amazing things about the Plano project itself, because you do have, you know, people who will say, well, you know, infrastructure only works up to a certain point. You know, it may work for the next 10 years, but what's really going to be the longer-term effect? You really can't, in any linear, formal way, look into the type of impact that fresh running water for a four-year-old child could have in Sonora. I mean, that's a big difference. There's a difference between a child growing up with access to basic infrastructure, such as food and water, versus a child who doesn't. you can't really calculate what type of effect that's going to have on that child's mind. So I think in the process of creating that, you start to generate that type of quality that can create those conditions where food and water would be available to everyone. But people understanding why that's so important. And I think that's probably the best way that we'll start to get out of the idea of monetary thinking and start to think more on a level like human beings. So I'll just reemphasize that, for the listeners.
That's an extremely important point. I'm glad you brought that up. We do have an email in that I want to throw out to the two of you asking two questions, basically. First is, how safe are the borders in the San Diego-Tijuana area? Freddie already mentioned that, but you may want to say something more on it. But then the second part of the question is, can we win the war on drugs? This is from Paula Mae Larson from Nebraska, who says that, look, in the 1980s, when George Bush Sr. was running the CIA and other agencies, the drug war was pretty much shut down because the U.S. government under Bush was running drugs. And this, of course, gets back to Soros, but she says, is this a losing battle? Can we win the war on drugs? So let me throw it out to either of you.
Yeah, yes, we can. And that's number one, as the questioner illustrated, the problem has been the political will, not anything about the feasibility of actually doing it, but there being a joint collaboration between nations to completely crush and eradicate the drug trade. And that's something, a small potential for that is seen with the kind of collaboration between the United States, France, and Colombia that occurred last year to free the hostages from the FARC. But just on the larger scale, right now our organization has just launched something which LaRue saw. Currently,
Tarana? Yeah, we're losing Tarana again.
Can you hear me?
Now I can, yes.
Okay, hopefully this will be better. Let me try that again. So we're currently launching internationally, organized by our organization, an operation called Operation Afghanistan, which has really three levels to it. One is renewing the investigation that we had done about a decade ago on the kinds of technologies available, including space-based systems, to eradicate drug crops, to locate and eradicate drug crops. The second being to monitor the entrance of drugs or the smuggling of drugs into nations using various technologies such as MRI, etc. And then the third level being really the most important at this point, which is the exposing and crushing of the money laundering apparatus which really fuels the drug trade. And this brings us to something which for a PCORA commission. And something that he was questioned yesterday in his webcast was, does this narco-terrorism war on drugs coincide with your call for a PCORA commission? And the only way, ultimately, that this war on drugs will be one is through exposing these networks, people like George Soros, bringing them to trial, and that can only be done this time as opposed to nationally in the United States as PCORA led internationally on a worldwide scale.
Well, I think, Tarana, it's important to note that that's something that Lyndon LaRouche has been warning about and organizing for since the late 1970s when we published the original book, Dope Incorporated, which went through how
Well, we've had a little technical difficulty here. A static charge has taken both telephone lines off the air. I'll try to get it back on in a second here.
Hello, you've reached American System Publications.
Hello, ASC.
Put Harley back on. We had a static charge that took the entire show off the air.
Okay.
Conference system. After the tone, please enter.
It continues to grow. It will be. Hello. Hello.
Okay.
Yeah. Hold on. Go ahead. You have to hang up, Marty. Yeah, we're hooked up. Go ahead.
Okay.
Just wow. Disconnect that completely.
Go ahead,
Freddie.
Okay. I mean, I think it's. You know, maybe as the population continues to expand, you know, we're going to have to address this issue of how do we maintain a growing population. And it's definitely going to be going out to the Eurasian continent in general. I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of potential in Russia and just neighboring countries that we're going to have to do. So I think we are making it an issue now. Our Political Action Committee is shaping policy with respect to Russia, with respect to how they should go about practicing economy and moving away from monetarism and understanding more the idea of the credit system. And so I think within the next few months, you know, obviously that's something that is going to be put on the table. I mean, as a policy platform, we've had the development of the Eurasian continent, but I think we're going to have to start bringing it back much more than we've been discussing it with this next administration. So it's really all dependent on how much we organize for this as a population, whether it be on the grassroots level or on an institutional level.
Yeah, this goes back to the Four Powers Agreement that LaRouche has put forward, and again, I'm sorry for our technical problems. Clearly, we haven't solved our own infrastructure situation here. There are some changes, I'm told by our technical staff, that the LaRouche show technically will be up to a higher level starting next week. But in any case, on this Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, we'll have Lyndon LaRouche doing the second of his two webcasts. The first one was yesterday. That's available to you on LaRouchePAC.com. The second one, Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And these are two webcasts that are on either side of the inauguration. The inauguration of President-elect Obama, of course, is on Tuesday the 20th. And what Lyndon LaRouche is doing with these webcasts is providing a direction, a clear direction, of what the Obama administration could do on day one to bring the United States economy out of this disintegration and back into a positive physical production that will lift the world out of this dark age. Now, we're down to about 5 or 6 minutes. I'd like to just come back to this, the work that's being done overall with the videos. And Tarana, you and Freddie, I know this took a long time to put together, and it's well worth it. The Plino Nawapa video, which we're talking about today, is up on the website. But we've had a whole series of these shorter news stories. What's the general conception from the LaRouche PAC editorial staff that we're doing to bring these stories in both shorter and longer version to the population? How do you see that, Tarana?
Well, especially I can give the example of the holiday period where most people are probably used to not getting any real news or any real political discussion in that period. And in that time, we at LaRouche PAC headquarters were in the midst of churning out at least 2 to 3 of these LPAC TV news shorts daily, which if any of the listeners haven't been to the website or don't know about this or somehow don't know how to use their computer yet, unfortunately, you've got to do it. This is the forefront of our ammunition for the political mm-hmm. fight that we need to wage right now. Not just for yourself, not just for the ability to keep yourself briefed on the most breaking developments, announcements from LaRouche himself, initiatives that we're taking, pedagogies on some of these scientific concepts that we're discussing, but also to be able to take out to other people, to give other people the links, to download it, to show other people these shorts and begin to organize other people to become members, and which really means participants in this fight that we're waging right now. And just two that I can point to that everybody should go visit that just came up last night. There's a one on chlorophyll, which really gets to this question of nuclear power and the future of powered energy development for our nation, and the other on not global warming, but global cooling and our move into an ice age. So this is really important ammunition for people to be using every day.
I think someone should email the one on global cooling to President-elect Obama, because in his speech in Philadelphia yesterday, he made a big deal about the earth is warming and we've got to figure out how to cool it. So maybe if he goes to LaRouche PAC TV, he'll get the answers from Peter Martinson. Now, Freddie, you're going to be leading an organizing team from the United States that will link up with the Mexican LaRouche Youth Movement and Vizcada in Sonora soon. What are you expecting to accomplish from your trip there?
Well, as LaRouche had stated, make Mexico proud of Sonora. I mean, there's just a tremendous amount. There's going to be a few people from the United States that will be headed into Sonora, and we will have different conferences, different forums, around the Plano Project, the necessity of its construction. So we expect a lot of good things to happen. You know, we'll be doing a lot of work on universities and hopefully involving the students more and more and more into adopting that type of political identity to make this thing a reality. So it should be a lot of fun. It should be a lot of fun.
And if people who are listening to this want to support this activity, I would urge you to call the number that you see on the website for LaRouche PAC and make contributions, because the work that's being done for young American members of the LaRouche Youth Movement to go into Mexico, to be able to organize, to put this kind of picture together, we need support. And the number you can call for that, the LaRouche PAC number, is 800-929-7566. It's 800-929-7566. Since this is a new year, you can now give up to $5,000 to LaRouche PAC. And people who are listening and want to support this activity, make sure that Freddie is able to go in there and maximize the potential, and also to produce the DVDs. Tarana, you said we're going to be producing a DVD of this Nahuapa Plino, right?
Yeah, that's correct, and that's crucial also because it really is going to be the main ammunition that our team, both down there in Mexico and also here in Los Angeles or the greater Los Angeles area, will be using on the ground. So that's crucial infrastructure.
And also in Texas. So our listeners to this program, when you sit around thinking what's going to happen with the Obama administration, is LaRouche right? Is there a real potential? Well, you're part of that potential. And so besides listening to the webcast from yesterday and making sure you organize people to watch next Thursday, this coming Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern, give some money, talk to people, get them on the website, because it's up to us to make this a potential to move the country in a LaRouche FDR direction. So, Tarana and Freddie, thank you very much. I apologize to our listeners for the technical problems. We'll take care of that, and we'll be back next Saturday for another edition of The LaRouche Show. So we'll join you then, and don't forget the webcast Thursday at 1 p.m.